Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. It's a busy week this week. Today, House managers and the president's defense team offer their closing arguments in the president's impeachment trial. Tonight, Iowa voters caucus to give us the first big window into the Democratic side of the 2020 presidential race. Then tomorrow night, Tuesday, President Trump delivers his State of the Union address. And then on Wednesday, the Senate votes on whether to convict or acquit the president. Then on Friday, Democratic candidates descend upon New Hampshire for another presidential debate. So that leaves Thursday. Oh, poor Thursday, all alone. But at this rate, I am sure that something will happen on Thursday. So if your head is spinning, don't worry. This hour, we will hang on, slow down, and think through what this big week may mean for the shape and character of American democracy. And today, we're going to start with Jack Beatty, On Point news analyst, with us as always from Hanover, New Hampshire. Jack, welcome to Monday.
Hello, Meghna.
It's great to have you with me here on a Monday, Jack. And first of all, let me just get a sense from you and how you make sense of all that we're going to anticipate from this week. What do you think?
Well, it's going to begin with a decathlon of democracy, the Iowa caucuses, which put voters through hurdles, hoops. You've got to get in line before 7 in order to be permitted even into the one of 1,600 gyms or churches or libraries. And you've got to be willing to stay perhaps as long as 3 hours. And the results are going to be, well, they're going to be three different sets of numbers. They're going to be a delegate count, a support on the first alignment, support on the second alignment, producing not clarity, but possibly a chaos of victories. That is, three candidates may be able to claim wins. So welcome to the Iowa caucuses, and don't look for clarity here. Don't look for much clarity in the State of the Union address, I'm actually going to be watching the State of the Union address for the president's manner. His campaign has put out a video compiling Joe Biden's verbal gaffes and intimating, not subtly, that there's something wrong with Joe Biden. Well, last week in Wildwood, New Jersey, the president had a bad moment speaking, so bad that Fox News switched away, and you could hear a laugh in the studio and saying, okay, we're turning away from this disaster. I'm going to be watching how the president speaks. Does he slur his words? Does he stumble? And will this issue of his fitness in that way become an issue for him as he has made it an issue for Biden? Mm. And then, of course, on Wednesday, the foreordained result. We know what's going to happen, and we should have been prepared for it. And yet somehow, after the Bolton revelations and after the sort of feeling that there might be a turning point there, it's going to feel more depressing than simply the inevitable. To the inevitable, you adjust. To something that feels like it could have gone in another direction, you feel a certain anguish, and lots of Americans, at least half of them, are going to feel that as the president is acquitted.
Right. So, Jack, on that point, perhaps more broadly, the anguish, maybe a lot of people, regardless of whether they don't support or do support the president, the anguish they might be feeling is at this questioning of the basic functioning of American democracy. So let me lean on your considerable experience, Jack, here as a historian. I mean, I don't recall in my recent memory a week quite like this one, where we have, exactly as you've laid out, we've got we've got a presidential election major events. We have the results, the vote on the impeachment of a president. We have that same president giving a State of the Union address. I mean, is this week, might it be looked back upon 50 years from now as an historic week, or are we just in a world right now where literally every week feels like this?
Well, in one way, it could look historic, and that is depending who wins the Iowa caucus and whether that person goes on to be the nominee and goes on to defeat or not President Trump. If the wrong person wins, that is somebody who will lose in November, you could say, well, this was a fateful week. The president's numbers have been going up. The worse he does, judged against the standards of presidential performance that were considered axiomatic before Trump became president, the worse he does, it seems, lately, the better he's doing in the polls. He's not north of 50%. He's never been since president. But he's creeping up. And he's going to give tomorrow a speech talking about, you know, the great economic numbers. Mm. And they're certainly encouraging. So whether the week has precedent or not, it's certainly going to, it's going to feel that way. And there's going to be a sense of fatefulness about everything, I think.
Well, Jack, stand by here for just a second, because I'm going to bring a couple of other folks in to help us puzzle through this big week in the news. But first, let's just listen to a little bit of what Tennessee Republican Senator Lamar Alexander said just yesterday on NBC's Meet the Press, where he explained why he voted against bringing witnesses to the Senate trial of President Trump.
Well, I mean, if you have eight witnesses who say someone left the scene of an accident, why do you need nine? I mean, it's, the question for me was, do I need more evidence to conclude that the president did what he did? And I concluded, no.
Senator Lamar Alexander just yesterday. Well, joining us now from Washington is John Bresnahan, Capitol Hill bureau chief for Politico. John, welcome back to On Point.
Hi, Magna.
And Susan Page also joins us as well. She's Washington bureau chief for USA Today. Susan, it's great to have you back on the show as well.
Yeah, it's great to be with you again.
Okay, so Susan, let me just start with you, and I'll just sort of ask you the same question that I began with Jack here. When you look across the landscape of this week's news, kind of how do you start to make sense of it?
You know, I think this will turn out to be a really crucial week because, for one thing, we'll have a verdict in the impeachment trial. Just the third time in American history that that has happened. It may end up boosting the president. It may end up hurting the president. I think we need some time to unfold before we're sure about the effect. And we'll have the Democratic field at least get smaller, and we may have someone, a candidate, emerge as the likely nominee. So this is the week that, in a way, sets up the general election that people are so focused on in November.
Mm. And John, same question to you, especially given Friday's vote in the Senate on not having witnesses. It makes me wonder to whom will the House managers and the president's defense team, who are they delivering their closing arguments to the American people, to history, to whom?
Both. Of course, the Senate. The Senate will be listening today. They have 4 hours of closing arguments, 2 hours between each side, and then the vote will be Wednesday. But I do think that, you know, one of the most significant things here is that you're going to have two, you know, the House Republicans are going to have, you know, every one of them has said, you know, Trump is not guilty and voted against impeachment. And the same thing with Senate Republicans. We'll see if any Senate Republicans vote to find the president guilty, because – and it's cementing Trump's 100% total control of the Republican Party. That's, I think, was a huge – significant moment in the last couple of months that's really being overlooked here. This is – they've aligned themselves with him. He's at the top of the ticket in November, and, you know, they're going all in on Trump, and, you know, their fate relies with how Trump does when he goes before the voters in November.
Mm. Jack, your thoughts on that?
Yes, it is Trump's party, and, you know, there's both a carrot and a stick with Trump. He is giving money, or his PAC is, to the senators running. So he's paying them. And on the other hand, he's threatening them. Tom Tillis famously last year came out against the president's emergency declaration on the border, that he had to, you know, create a national emergency and shift money from the defense budget to build the wall. Tillis said, no, it's not a national emergency. Immediately, the Club for Growth began taking out ads against Mr. Tillis in North Carolina. He's up this year. And a primary opponent appeared. Tillis turned track. He said, oh, no, I'm for the emergency. I'm for the border wall. The primary opponent disappeared, or may, I believe, has done. And the Club for Growth stopped stopped slamming him. Carrot and stick, the president uses with these Republican senators, and he's made them supine.
Now, so Susan, let me turn back to you on that, because I'm trying to figure out really how to understand the vote on Friday to not hear witnesses in the Senate trial of the president and what seems inevitable that will happen on Wednesday here. And here's the bridge that I'm trying to build between the two, because, you know, and maybe both, maybe that bridge is found in Marco Rubio's statement about how he's going to vote. He's obviously going to vote to acquit the president. But, you know, in his statement, he quoted Senator Patrick Leahy, Democrat of Vermont, from a long time ago, saying a partisan impeachment cannot command the respect of the American people. It is no more valid than a stolen election. But earlier in that same statement, Senator Rubio says very clearly, just because actions meet the standard of impeachment does not mean it is in the best interest of the country to remove a president from office. I mean, are we at a point where, yes, an impeachment might be partisan, but that is because one of the parties refuses to see anything that the president does as unfitting of the office.
You know, Senator Rubio's comment was quite remarkable, and he actually tried to walk it back just a bit by saying he did not think afterwards, when it caused a furor, that he did not think Trump's behavior rose to an impeachable standard. But the fact is, I think Republicans generally endorse the idea behind Rubio's original statement. I mean, we've had the senators who might have been persuadable, at least on the question of witnesses, possibly on the question of impeachment, have generally adopted this line that what the president did was inappropriate, that maybe it crossed a line. That was a phrase one of the senators used, but did not amount to warranting his removal from office. And at this point, we're looking more for Democratic defections on Wednesday than we are for Republican defections.
Interesting. Okay, so when we come back, we'll also talk about what to expect or what to look for in the president's State of the Union address, which is tomorrow. So Susan Page, John Bresnahan, and Jack Beattie, stand by. We want to know what your questions are for this big week in the news. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/onpoint. That's Indeed.com/onpoint. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking through how to understand yet another very big week in the news. And I'm joined today to help us do that by Jack Beattie. He's On Point's news analyst. John Bresnahan is with us. He's Capitol Hill Bureau Chief for Politico. And Susan Page joins us. She's Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. Now, John, I said we were going to go on to the State of the Union, and we will in just a second. But because you do watch the Capitol so closely, I just wanted you to piggyback off what Susan was saying about who you're going to watch for when the actual vote on the impeachment trial happens on Wednesday. Susan was watching, thinking we should look for possible Democratic defectors. What do you think about that?
Yeah, absolutely. We're going to be watching six senators, three Republicans, three Democrats. On the Republican side, we'll watch Mitt Romney of Utah, Susan Collins of Maine, and Lisa Murkowski of Alaska. We expect they'll all vote to acquit the president, but we'll watch Romney very closely. He's been critical of the president. He voted four witnesses. He was one of only two Republicans, he and Collins, so we'll watch him closely. On the Democratic side, we're going to be watching Joe Manchin of West Virginia, Doug Collins of Alabama, and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona. All of them have suggested they could split their vote guilty on the abuse of power, but not guilty on obstruction of Congress. So we're going to watch that very closely. Jones was telling reporters the other day that he was impressed by what the president's team had to say about his case. Manchin has said he's not going to know how he's going to vote until he walks into the chamber. And Kyrsten Sinema is not saying anything to anybody. So she's a real mystery here.
Well, let's go to Dallas, who's calling from Norfolk, New York. Dallas, you're on the air. What's your question?
I would like to know why, if it's possible for them to have a censure of the president and not acquittal. And also, perhaps if they had not blocked their witnesses from appearing, they would have found the extent of the damage or the what had happened from Trump's action. And that would have been an emphasis to find him guilty. They might have changed their minds.
Well, Dallas, thank you for that question. Susan Page, are there any other options other than conviction or acquittal here?
Well, censure is not something that's laid out in the Constitution, but you could pass a resolution of censure against the president if you wanted to. That would presumably be a lower bar than impeachment. But Democrats would still need to pick up 4 Republican votes, and I'd be interested in what John thinks. It seems to me there's no percentage for Republicans to sign on to a proposal like that if indeed they could get it moving in the Senate. What do you think, John?
There has been a censure of one president. Andrew Jackson was censured. But as you say, I see very little chance of this happening. Back in 1999, Dianne Feinstein talked about censuring President Clinton. And, you know, she floated that a couple times. There has been some discussion of this. In fact, there was an op-ed today. Joe Lockhart, the former White House spokesman, and then Charlie Dent, a former Republican congressman from Pennsylvania, suggested censure as an option. But I think you're right. I just don't see any Republicans or significant number of Republicans voting for censure. You know, if you're not going to vote to impeach him and on a clearly what the American people think is an impeachable offense, then, you know, and I don't see how you would vote to censure him.
Jack, let me just jump in here and ask you, do you think it would behoove Democrats at all to pursue any other sort of actions against the president at this point? Because I think there is a strong calculus that says no, really what now which they ought to be really focusing on is the 2020 elections.
I think they're going to be cross-pressured on that from the Democratic base. On the one hand, yes, let's get on to the election. On the other hand, when John Bolton's book comes out next month, people are going to want to talk to John Bolton. And he did reject an initial subpoena or threat of a subpoena from the House. Would he answer one now? And if he would, I think they would probably, the Judiciary Committee, although I'm not sure, would want to hear from him. And that would keep it in the news. And also, you know, people who care about the national security and who believe that the president is unfit for office, people like Anonymous, you know, members of the Trump resistance within the Trump presidency, they've been leaking all along, and they're going to continue leaking, sending out their little SOSs about the state of Mr. Trump and the state of American democracy. And those may be things, may reveal things that Democrats want to dig into, Democrats in the House.
So now on to the question of the State of the Union address. And Susan, I'll turn to you on this. It does seem to me that if we take a step back, we could look at Tuesday night as potentially one of Donald Trump's most presidential moments, right? He could stand there and deliver a State of the Union address that shows him leading the country, that shows him, stewarding the nation through a period of economic growth, that shows him as being president even amidst this maelstrom of extreme historic political activity going on. It's a real opportunity for President Trump on Tuesday night.
You know, he could do that. I think if you look at how President Trump has generally spoken in the past 3 years, you would be surprised if that is his tone throughout the State of the Union. You know, I remember back in 1999, I covered the State of the Union when President Clinton was undergoing his Senate impeachment trial, where he spoke for 77 minutes, which is a long time. He did not say the word impeachment. I would be surprised if President Trump, even if his prepared remarks do not include a discussion of impeachment, I would expect him to talk about impeachment. It's on his mind. He's tweeting about it. He talks about it with reporters. It's obviously something that he doesn't like. He's attacking it as a hoax. And this as his the likely vote on Wednesday as his vindication. So I would be, I guess, surprised if I heard the kind of speech that you just talked about, because we have not seen President Trump really try to reach out in a serious way to those who do not support him so far during his presidency.
So, John, it sounds like Susan's looking for those potential off-script moments on Tuesday night. What about you?
That's going to be very interesting. I went back and reread Trump's last two State of the Union speeches. This is not his forte, these big set piece speeches. This is not his forte. Of course, his rallies, he's off the cuff. He'll riff for an hour, much longer. But these are it's not a great format for him. You have to stand there and read off the teleprompter, and it's a very formulaic kind of speech, and it's very policy heavy, and that's not where Trump makes his money with his voters. So it will be interesting to see how far he goes. It's what struck me in reading back on both those speeches was immigration and how he just presented the whole case, the whole southern border as a lawless state, the lawless state on the border, and how undocumented immigrants were coming to this country and committing crimes. And it'll be interesting to see how far he's going now, three years into his presidency. But again, he has a very good economic message. If he stays on that, which is what Republicans are dying to hear, that's a powerful message for a president up for re-election.
Jack, your thoughts on that?
Yes. I mean, any other president would stay on the economic message and would look abroad and say, look, we have troubles abroad, but wars are no war, peace. And would pitch to the median voter, that independent voter who's already softening toward Trump. But the fuel of Trumpism is grievance, resentment, anger. Can he stay away from that fuel? Oh, boy, that's going to be tough for him, I think.
Okay, well, let's go back to the phones. Let's go to Daniel, who's calling from New Orleans. Daniel, you're on the air.
Hi. My question is about the impeachment trial. Cipollone has been obvious in his use of calling Democrats to task for their opinions on the Clinton impeachment, as of other Republicans, mirroring, like you said, Marco Rubio, quoting a Democrat from the past. My question is, why have the Republicans not been held to task on their more bullish opinions from the Clinton impeachment? Why have people not called to them to support their opinions from the past? Is it because Democrats don't want to add retrospective credibility to that impeachment? I'm just curious what you guys think.
Daniel, interesting question. Susan Page, you have an answer for him?
I've had the hypocrisy alerts from both sides.
Right.
The fact is, that's the inconvenient thing about surviving long enough in politics that you go through your second impeachment. But on the other political side, I think there have been any number of efforts on both sides to point out how inconsistent the messages are on the standards for impeachment and the appropriateness of the enterprise and so on. Wait to hear more. We're going to have 4 hours of closing arguments today. I expect to hear perhaps a little more of that.
Okay, so Susan, if I may, this is going to sound – maybe I'm just outing myself as being spectacularly naive, and I'm going to just accept responsibility for that. But I don't think I'm the only American here who's wondering – why is there no consequence for this kind of hypocrisy anymore?
For the hypocrisy? Well, there is some consequence, and the consequence is the erosion of faith in our politics generally. I mean, I think that is one of the factors that makes so many Americans kind of throw up their hands and not trust anything anybody tells them, because they assume everyone is operating from a point of partisanship or personal advantage.
John, what do you think?
Oh, I think Susan's exactly right. There has been a lot of hypocrisy alerts. For instance, Chuck Schumer, the Democratic leader, has been pounding Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, over the fact that McConnell in 1999, he voted for witnesses in the Clinton impeachment case, and other Republicans did as well. So they've hit back on the Republicans about this. I do think that, now that we have these on video, what you say on, TV and video lasts forever, or on NPR, what you say lasts forever. Each side hits each other, but we've kind of, as the media, we've kind of let this slide. You say, well, in this situation, we understand it's situational for them. Well, it's my side versus their side. It's very tribal, my guy's right. I mean, listen, Democrats in 1999 criticized Clinton, but all voted to acquit him.
Right.
I mean, there was not one Democrat who voted to, that he was guilty on both charges in the Senate, went back and looked at the vote again. So, I mean, and remember that infamous rally he had with House Democrats down at the White House after the House impeached him in 1990. We've seen, we've seen kind of similar things this time. So, it is situational. They the lawmakers believe that, voters don't remember things now. And it's harder these days. In the Trump era, something 3 months ago will seem like forever, So,
yeah.
I mean, it's, 3 weeks ago seems like forever now.
Well, it might be on video forever, but in the minds of voters, it might be for one hot second because there is so much going on. But
right.
Actually, so Susan Page, this is a great way for us to turn to talk about the Iowa caucuses that are happening now, our first big window into what at least Democratic voters in Iowa might be showing as what they value in the kind of person they want to see run against President Trump. So what are you going to be looking for?
Well, let's see about the Bernie Sanders surge. Bernie Sanders almost won last time against Hillary Clinton. He's showing doing well in the latest polls that we've seen out of Iowa. This is a candidate who I think some Democrats thought couldn't possibly be nominated because he's too far left. He's not really a Democrat. He's a Democratic socialist. And yet he's been showing a lot of strength and enthusiasm. That has alarmed, I think, more centrist and establishment Democrats. We've heard alarm from Hillary Clinton, for one, and this interesting story about John Kerry, also a former Democratic presidential nominee, who was at the Gathering Point Hotel in Des Moines and had a cell phone conversation, which he seemed to suggest he might jump into this race if Bernie Sanders did well in the Iowa caucuses tonight. John Kerry now has said, no, he doesn't actually plan to enter this race.
Yeah, I mean, that was one of those moments where you're like, what? Okay. Well, John Bresnahan, what will you be looking for?
Well, we'll see the field narrowing down, of course. And then, New Hampshire can lead to different outcomes. It doesn't. I'm sorry, the New Hampshire can lead to a different outcome than Iowa, and that's only a week from now. So we'll really, I think, can Biden, Sanders, and Warren really step away from the rest of the field? Does Buttigieg really have legs? After that, I expect, this next week worth of voting, to kind of winnow down the Democratic field and say, and then voters will, again, they'll take another look at, who survives. And then we head into South Carolina and then Nevada. So I know as depressing as folks are about, some folks are about Trump's impeachment and what happened, it is good. I mean, the democratic process is working. We're going to start seeing, a nominee who's going to challenge Trump come forward, and we'll see who that is. But I mean, I think in some ways it's reassuring that, this is actually happening.
Well, John Bresnahan, Capitol Hill Bureau Chief for Politico, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
And Susan Page, Washington Bureau Chief for USA Today. It was great to talk with you, Susan.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
All right. Well, let's focus more. Let's really drill down here on Iowa because those caucuses are a big deal today. And joining us now from Des Moines, Iowa, is Anthony Brooks. He's On Point's 2020 political correspondent. Hello, Anthony.
Hey, Meghna. Great to talk to you.
Okay. So what have you seen in the past couple of days in Iowa?
Yeah, interesting. I mean, I think it's fair to say that this race remains up for grabs between the four leading candidates: Bernie Sanders, Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, and Pete Buttigieg, all of whom are within a few points of each other, according to the most recent polls. That said, there's a sense that Sanders is very much the front runner, benefiting from some late momentum. So arguably, he's peaking at a pretty good time. He's had some huge crowds this past weekend, including a crowd of 3,000 in Cedar Rapids. But Iowa is also a state that rewards the ground game. He's got a good one, but so does Elizabeth Warren. She's viewed as having one of the best get-out-the-vote operations in the state. She had some big events with lots of excitement over the weekend. But, Meghna, I think what I'm struck by is how many voters I've talked to as recently as yesterday who say they're still undecided. And I think that speaks to this quandary for lots of Democrats. Should you vote your heart, Or should you vote for the candidate that you think other people think has the best chance of beating Trump? And it's sort of tying lots of folks out up in knots out here.
Well, so, Jack, I do recall that last time we talked to you about Iowa, you pointed out that Iowa voters don't have a great history of picking winners. But they do serve a very important purpose in perhaps winnowing down the field, especially given that quandary that Anthony has described that voters might be feeling. So what do you think about that?
Yes, I mean, there'll be fewer candidates, or there should be. Although, you know, in the age of crowdsourcing and, you know, online fundraising and so on, candidates can keep going almost on fumes. I'm struck with the poll that shows, recent poll that shows 73% of Iowans, of Iowa Democrats, want the candidate with the best chance of beating Trump. 58% want big policy changes. It would seem that electability is the crucial thing to them. The trouble is, what is it? How do you find it?
Well, Jack and Anthony, hang on here, because when we come back, we're going to be hearing from two Iowa voters, and we'll put that very question to them. So we are talking about another big week in the news, impeachment, the Iowa caucuses, the State of the Union. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking about another big week in the news, everything from the impeachment trial of President Trump to the Iowa caucuses to the president's State of the Union address. And if you're a Democrat in Iowa, we'd love to hear from you. Are you tied up in knots, as Jack Beatty says, between caucusing for someone you think could beat President Trump versus the candidate that may have captured your heart? And for Republican listeners everywhere, what's the question that you have that will help you understand or helps you understand what you're seeing across the news and across the country this week? Now, I do want to turn back to Iowa and speak with two Iowa voters. So joining me now from Cedar Rapids is Ann Solomon. She was a Cory Booker supporter and works as a hospital pharmacist as well. Ann, welcome back to On Point.
Thanks for having us.
Also is Ann's next-door neighbor, Libby Slappy. She joins us as well from Cedar Rapids. She's going to be caucusing for Pete Buttigieg. Libby, welcome back to you.
Great to be back. Thanks, Meghna.
Okay, I have to tell you both, Libby and Ann, that I have never received as many emails as I did after we had you two on not that long ago when we did our own sort of on-point mini-caucus here. You really inspired a lot of Americans, the two of you, in terms of the civil and thoughtful conversation that you had across the lawn here, so to speak. So thank you so much for coming back. But Ann, let me just start with you. You know how Jack asked that question about being tied in knots versus between trying to caucus for the person you think might be able to beat President Trump and the person that your heart wants to follow with the big ideas. Are you also tied up in knots about that still?
I'm uncomfortable. I'm sitting here wearing my Cory Booker button, and my husband and I both intend to first gather around if anybody else wants to join us for Cory as our first preference tonight. We did go hear Amy Klobuchar a week or so ago, and after listening to her, I approached her and I said, you know, I'm a Cory Booker fan. Why should I now vote for you? Should I choose you as my candidate? And we talked a little bit, and she's close to what I was looking for in Cory. So,
well, what did she tell you?
Well, she's a moderate. She's she was empathetic. She said in her stump speech that she is not pie in the sky, but she's practical, and she's willing to shoot for the goals, but needs to work with what we've got right now, which is the message that I heard from Cory. Mm. So she's got experience. Every candidate's going to have some things that bother you or that you kind of worry about. I worry about her being known outside of the Midwest. I worry about Trump making mincemeat of her. But on the other hand, she has some spunk. So that appealed to me.
Yeah.
So I think she might be my backup.
So, Libby, it sounds like you haven't succeeded in swaying Ann over to Pete Buttigieg's corner.
Well, I was working on her last night at the Super Bowl party at our church, Christ Episcopal Church in Cedar Rapids. And I'll be honest and say we got pretty caught up in just the mechanics of how the precinct caucus works.
Yeah.
So didn't get her swayed. Just thrilled to know that she's still undecided.
So there's all hope against hope. Yeah.
If Amy's not viable, I'm going to have to keep track of there'll be a few of us who, for principle's sake, will gather for Corey. But then we're going to have to keep a track of Amy's group to see if it's viable or not. I don't want to get locked out and have to do another choice after her.
Mm-hmm. But let me just turn back to you here for a second, because you are going to be caucusing for Pete Buttigieg here.
Yes.
So you see him as a candidate, a Democratic candidate who could potentially beat President Trump in a general election?
Oh, I absolutely do. Time and time again, as I'm in the community, I've got my Pete button on, and whether it's the clerk at Walgreens or a patron at the public library, someone that I don't know, they see my button and they say to me, "I really like him." And I say, "I do too." And then I happen to have Commit to Caucus cards in my purse, and I say,
"Why am I not surprised?
Would you like to say?" Well, I say, "Are you going to caucus?" And they say, "Yes." And then I say, "Would you like to sign a Commit to Caucus card for Pete?" And literally, I've gotten cards signed that way.
Anthony Brooks, I mean, talk about a ground game. Libby's got
knocking on the doors I knocked on.
Anthony Brooks, what do you think about what you're hearing from Anne and Libby?
Well, I mean, this is the great thing about Iowa and the way these caucuses are set up, of course, and Anne and Libby know this better than anybody. I mean, the opportunity to convince and cajole and, work on your neighbors and convince them to make their second choice, your first choice, their second choice to become their first choice is exactly what the caucus system is all about. So it sounds like Anne, was that Anne or Libby?
That was Libby,
it sounds
yeah.
like you've started, Libby, it sounds like you've started that process well ahead of the game. This is what the whole thing is about out here.
Well, let's go to Roy, who's calling from Norwalk, Iowa. Roy, you're on the air.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. So I'm going to wear my Joe Biden t-shirt tonight, and I'm going to caucus for Bernie. I think, and the reason is, I think Bernie's got the only shot of winning. And I'm hoping, and I think if he doesn't get the nomination on the way out, the Bernie bros are going to tear apart the Democratic Party.
Wait, Roy, hang on. You think Sanders has the only shot of winning Iowa or winning the general?
No, winning against Trump. Winning against Trump. So, I think if he doesn't get the nomination, they're going to be so divisive that they'll literally just tear the party apart. And hopefully, even if he wins or loses, it'll pop the kind of populist bubble that's enveloping the country in this craziness, and we'll get back to some solidarity for each other.
But you're going to be Biden t-shirt? Just Roy, you're going to be wearing a Biden t-shirt, though? Meaning
I'm
what?
I'm wearing my Joe t-shirt because I love Joe, but I'm gonna caucus for Bernie because he's the only one. Sure.
Yeah. Can I make two comments?
Is that you, Ann?
This is Ann.
Okay, Ann, go ahead.
This is one of the things, and I was in the discussion on Facebook wall, because after the last thing, a friend was trying to persuade me for Bernie. And this is the thing about Bernie and his supporters. They're not unifiers. He's not a unifier. And I think the country wants to take a breath. They don't want to see the pendulum swing to the far left in the same version of a left version of Trump. I think they want a breath of air. That's what I heard when I knocked on all those doors. The second thing is, if the youth vote, say, the 25 to 35-year-olds get Bernie as our nominee, then I want to see their little tushes out there in October knocking on doors and getting the 55-year-olds and older out to vote, because the moderate older voter who is guaranteed to vote even in the school board elections is going to not want to vote for Bernie. And so that means you have to offset that with the young vote. And will they get out and vote for him then?
Okay,
that's
but,
the key.
And so you're saying that the moderate older voter won't vote for Sanders, but why?
Because he's too far left.
Too far left. Okay, Libby, what do you think?
You know, this is a tough one for the unity question among our Democratic Party members. As I was on Doors, no question about it, people want Trump out. And everyone says, whoever our nominee is, that's who I'll support. So if Bernie is the nominee.
I have two people who opted out.
Well,
actually, three. Two of them were Bernie supporters. One was a Warren, who said they would not necessarily vote for the party nominee if it wasn't their person, which saddened me.
Well, I think we have to all pull up our big donkey pants and, you know, go out and vote for our nominee.
Well, that's the key, is if whoever does get the nomination, or will they support each other? In my research this past weekend, I saw a picture of Biden putting his hand and talking very candidly with Andrew Yang. And it's that sense of coming together and being one behind whoever it is to further the goal of actually capturing the White House.
Well, Anne Solomon and Libby Slappy, you guys have caucuses to focus on for this evening, so I'm going to let you go now. But thank you both so much for coming back to On Point. And Libby, one of these days I'm going to take you up on your kind invitation for dinner and talking politics at your house, okay?
I'm going to get you out here, Magna, I promise.
She's a good
I'm
cook. Oh, Magna,
it.
She's a good cook.
I don't doubt it at all. So Libby Slappy and Anne Solomon, thank you so very much for coming back to On Point. Jack Beattie, let me turn back to you here, because you heard Anne there saying, and Roy, our caller from Norwalk, Iowa, also concerned about what the impact might be if Sanders does indeed come out of Iowa as the winner of the caucuses there. Now Bernie Sanders, during the Democratic National Convention in 2016, did stand up and throw his personal full weight behind Hillary Clinton. But to Anne's concern, that didn't necessarily translate into all of his supporters then turning towards supporting Hillary Clinton. Could something potentially like that happen again?
It could. In fact, there was an alarming poll from that point of view recently, just last week, that showed that if you ask supporters of the Democratic candidates, if your guy or woman doesn't win, will you support the winner? For all the candidates, 85, 90, 95%. Except you get to Bernie supporters, only 56% of them said they would support the eventual nominee. And it is, while we're on the alarming statistic track, from that point of view, I think the figure is about a million Bernie voters in the primaries in 2016 voted for Mr. Trump. They're not really Democrats at heart. They're Democrats because Bernie is one. And their main loyalty, maybe even their exclusive one, is to Bernie and his ideas.
Okay, well, so let's go to Jonathan now, who's calling from Boone, Iowa. Jonathan, Jack says that your loyalty, if you're a Sanders supporter, is to Bernie Sanders and not necessarily the Democratic Party. What do you think?
Well, I think that's part of what's happening, is that Bernie Sanders is bringing in tens of millions of voters who the Democratic Party has been bleeding out for decades. They've been losing because they haven't been standing up and fighting for working people. They haven't been doing that visibly. Bernie, so this question of good policy versus electability, I just think it's false, because it's the good policies. When you take on big pharma, when you take on big insurance, when you take on Wall Street, when you take on that greed, that's getting working people who feel abandoned by the Democratic Party excited, back in the fold, ready to vote, ready to throw down. So that's why, you know, there's so many people who don't want to really have anything to do with the Democratic Party because of NAFTA, because of the Iraq War. Sanders, by being bold on those policies, is bringing us back into the fold. And that's how we win. That's how we get the enthusiasm that's going to beat Trump. And that's why I think it's so important. Honestly, I think Sanders is the only candidate who can beat Trump in the general election, because you need that enthusiasm and you need the young people who are out knocking doors from all over the country.
Well, Jonathan, let me ask you. So obviously you're going to be caucusing for Sanders tonight in Iowa. But you heard your fellow Iowan Ann a couple of minutes ago saying that she sees many supporters of Senator Sanders as being quite divisive. Why do you think that is?
I think it's an unfair rap. I think that all of the different folks who support candidates are enthusiastic about their candidates, and I think the establishment has tried to frame Sanders supporters as particularly divisive for some reason. I just don't think it's true. I don't buy it. You know, I see it on Twitter, and all the different folks are divisive in different ways.
Yeah.
And I think part of it is, you know, Sanders is actually picking a long overdue fight in the Democratic Party for the soul of the party, mm-hmm. for the direction, for the leadership, taking on, you know, big moneyed interests that too many Democrats have become so comfortable with. They've become resigned that this is the game. You court big money. Well, you know, that's not the game. It can't be. That's how we've been losing so many working people. And by working people, I don't just mean working white people. I mean people of color. Yeah. I mean white people. So
well, Jonathan, you're going to have to forgive me for taking it back from you, but I've got 2 minutes left and I want to hear what both Anthony and Jack have to say about that. But Jonathan, thank you so much for your call. So Anthony, again, we got about 2 minutes here. Really interesting thing.
Yeah, and I'd love to sort of chime in with what I've seen from Sanders supporters and Sanders himself out here. Because one point that Sanders makes, and he made it as recently at Indianola, where I saw him over the weekend, he takes great pains at the beginning of all of his speeches to say no matter who wins, no matter which Democrat wins, he's going to throw his weight behind him. And he takes behind that Democrat, whether it's he or her. And he makes great pains to do that. And I'm finding that as well among his supporters. Yes, they are probably the most energized supporters of all of the Democratic voters out here that I've talked to. But I would say, generally speaking, they absolutely concede the idea that if Sanders doesn't get the nomination, they're going to support whatever Democrat does. And so I think that's an important thing. And I think the caller made the point that where you hear that kind of inflexibility more than ever is on Twitter. And that's a certain subset of Sanders supporters that I don't think are necessarily fairly reflects the broad swath of Sanders supporters that you see. I can't imagine huge numbers of Sanders supporters turning their back on the next Democratic nominee if it's not Sanders.
Well, Jack Beattie, we've got 30 seconds left, and I just wanted to hear your quick response to that.
Well, Bernie's strategy is mobilize non-voters. The trouble is, since 1972, we haven't topped 58% turnout in our elections. That's a tough road. The other way to do it is the Pete Buttigieg way, and that's conversion. And when you convert a Republican to a Democrat, you get two votes. Trump loses one, you gain one. So that's the debate.
Well, we will see what happens tonight in Iowa. And then very quickly, attention moves to where you are, Jack, in New Hampshire. So, Jack Beattie, On Point News Analyst, thank you so much for joining us today, Jack.
Thank you.
And Anthony Brooks, On Point's 2020 political correspondent in Iowa today. Anthony, it was great to talk with you. Thank you.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.